I did not create a talk with a capital T today, because I thought morning events were enough formality that maybe we could have a kind of conversation this afternoon about practice, about the things that puzzle you, the ways that you've solved some things that might be helpful for other people. Your understanding about Ango and what it means to you, a practice period where you actually pull your life up together and focus on practice. There are many, many things that we can talk to each other about, because we're all not monks and nuns, and yet living this in-between kind of life, in-between kind of spiritual life, in which we have houses and families and just get together occasionally for an occasion like this. In an occasion like this, then we are monks and nuns as long as we're here. So, of course, there are many things that are extremely truly marvelous about living this kind of life, this coming and going kind of life. And the challenge of maintaining our vows, maintaining our intention, really depends on how we understand the Dharma. So it means study is very much important in this challenge of in-between life. To understand the Dharma well enough to bring it into whatever situation that we find ourselves. Buddha just walked around and was with all different kinds of people. From very, very wealthy people, merchants, to courtesans, to kings, to shepherds, to kids and bums, murderers. So although they met during the rainy period, he and his monks, in one place, and deepened their practice, and that's how we inherited Ango. That's where the practice period came from. Usually people were all out there, but they came together in the rain. They stayed in a cave up on Rajgir Mountain. They stayed in many places. And although it seems strange, we're duplicating that. Although we're not having any rain, sometimes it actually snows here at this time of year and makes it harder. And yet we gather in this way and share our lives together. And our lives are built on top of all those other lives. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives. Each one carrying the Dharma forward in their family, in their monastery, in their sangha, in their community. But somehow, this message of wisdom and compassion has traveled through time and space all the way to here. And we look around and see it isn't happening everywhere. But it's astonishing in how many places it shows up. I decided to read Moby Dick one more time before I die. Since you could take it into a Kindle in a flash. So I have the big one with the Rockwell Kent illustrations, but I'm now reading it in Kindle. That whole fat book is squished into this flat little thing. And the Dharma's shooting all through that book. Now that writer had tremendous insight, and was able to express it. So it's not that we have to be Buddhists. Dogen always said, don't call yourself a Buddhist, or you should wash your mouth out with soap. Because it creates such a sense of separation. If I'm a Buddhist and you're a Christian, then already we've set something up between us that doesn't need to be there. I think our job is to take down all those barriers by deep study of the teaching of the great masters. All of them saw our problem, and all of them saw the solution, which was to develop an understanding of how deeply connected we are with each other and what our deepest wish is and how to manifest our deepest wish. So our work as ordinary beings, you could say, is to continually keep in mind our connection with those who came before, who, if you're a Tibetan, feels that they're all here with us. I often feel that myself. They're all here, supporting us on our practice. And to keep in mind the teachings, which are so few and so simple that it doesn't take a PhD in order to understand them or to be able to embody them. We can embody generosity. We can embody the precepts, an ethical life, and a vigorous life. And especially a life of meditation. So I know some people have corners in the room, or some people have a closet, or some little shack out in the backyard. Some place that is special just for meditation. And that itself creates a little world of it, which calls in all the rest. Living here at Chikoji, of course, it's obvious. And anywhere we sit down, we're sitting down as it. But our challenge is when we go home to create a little stability kind of place where we can go and be safe, feel safe, and connect. Even if it's not a long time, maybe if we have a very busy life, but 10 minutes changes your brain for the whole day. And we wouldn't be here if we didn't know that it makes a difference sitting for a long time. So I thought we could talk about that, about your experience, your challenges, if you have children, if you have a high-pressure job, if you don't have a place to practice, if you don't want to practice anymore, don't like it, or went away for a long time and then came back. There are many permutations of as many as there are us. But each one is a kind of illustration of how rich this situation is that we find ourselves in. And in some senses, how strange.
You spoke specifically to my question when you mentioned that you don't have to be a Buddhist to understand the Dharma, in Dogen's quote about not calling yourself a Buddhist. I'm living here at Jikoji, and I am going to do the practice period here. I was scheduled to do the practice period at Green Gulch, but Mike and Mado set up a system so we could basically have the same experience here, very similar as far as the daily. So my question to you is, why am I doing the practice period? Ultimately, I have to say it's so that in the hopes that I will feel better. I also, in order to feel better, I feel I would want to do something for the benefit of other beings and for the benefit of myself. So when you make a vow, like I'm making to do the practice period, for the benefit of others and for the benefit of myself, in me, there's also a conflicting thought. Of reason of doing it is because I can say I did it. You know, I had this experience and I persevered and wow, I really did that. And sometimes those two maybe conflicting motives and thoughts, I kind of wonder actually at a point why I am doing it. Am I doing it to say I did it, and because it's you know, a cool thing to do, or am I doing it with a more pure motive? And sometimes I don't know.
That's the best way.
Don't know.
Just don't know. And let it tell you. It isn't personal. So you don't have to make it personal. It's what Mike was talking about this morning. There's something that brought us all here. A charge, you could say. And so, not knowing is an important part of that.
That's so hard. Not knowing for someone like me.
Yes. Well, and we've been so highly trained to think our way through things. And in this practice, we can't think our way through. We have to trust.
Mm.
And have to give up our self-image as well.
How do you do that?
By seeing it clearly, seeing what a joke it is. And sitting is very useful for that. We would like to be liked. We would like to be seen by everyone. We would like to be successful. In the middle of a life in which perhaps that those are, things are true and perhaps they're not. But our job is to see what's really true.
Similar kind of thought about coming here for a session, not knowing what to expect, and the very same idea, a lot of times thinking and thinking and thinking, oh boy, my legs are going to hurt, but boy, that's the monastic life I always wanted, and if you want to be the real Zen guy, you got to do a session. But then there's all the stuff in the back of the head that says, no attainment. You have no single self. You just sit. And so maybe this is a more concentrated effort along those lines. But it's very easy to have that thing clicking back there, which is sort of the next rung on the ladder next to learning the road or getting ordained or going to India. And I just had the very same kind of thoughts. And of course, now I'm very happy that I'm here. Can let all that go and go dig a ditch or hit the hon or whatever it is. But I found the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I have a situation at home where there's a big, where there's an enclave. And the biggest part of it is not as wide as the room, and the house we live in is here, and then there's a garage we share with a house that's down below in the canyon, and then there's a house there, and a house here, and a house in front, and a house in front, and the house here has a nice younger couple that moved in, who all of a sudden, about 6 months after they moved in, she started screaming at me that I was crazy, and her dog had bit me twice. Not bit the skin, but just bit me enough to bruise me. And at first it made me very frightened, and then I've just worked with myself to hold her and myself in compassion, because I don't know why she's so angry. She put up a big fence. She put up a fence too. Inside of a small fence, she put a large fence. That doesn't really match, but that's what she needed to do. And then she put a big sign, a big yellow sign that says, posted, no trespassing, no hunting, prosecutors will be. And this is a little, it looks, a lot of people say it looks like a little English countryside. And we have this posted, no hunting sign, which some of my friends come and they think it's a joke how you could put up a. So I really try to use the Dharma to see that there's no separation, that we're just all one there, and but it's hard not to get, hooked by that kind of slamming doors when she sees me, and just, I don't quite know what else to do besides just do metta a lot.
Have you been to see her?
I've tried to talk to her. She refuses to speak with me and won't let me then put the sign up about no hunting. I'm hardly a hunter. So I guess, you know, enough of my friends thought it was, they didn't know the story and thought it was a joke, so I'm just trying to laugh about it now.
Yeah.
Not laugh at her, but just...
Yeah, she's disturbed.
Yeah. She doesn't act. Other than that, she acts, she works, she's an attorney and she works with foster kids.
Odd. Yeah. Maybe it's so hard, her work, that she's had it when she comes home.
Yeah.
Mm. There's always somebody like that in a neighborhood.
The Dharma's very helpful, though.
Yeah.
To hold the chaos.
Yes, you know what to do. Doug.
You spoke of targets earlier today, and it sounds like you're a target. And she has a tough job, and there must be, she needs an outlet, and it's better shooting at a safe target than someone that's going to fire back. It's nice to have space around people like that. I mean, it's not just distance, but thinking about them and their conditions. It helps with the compassion, I guess, and patience with them too. It'll be interesting to hear a year from now or how things transpire, because it's not a static condition. So would you agree she's kind of like a target?
She's a scapegoat.
A scapegoat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they always, in ancient Greece, choose a goat to suffer all the sins of everybody else. They would treat it like it was everybody else, and it would be the sinner. So, and that's a kind of target. Being a teacher is another kind of target, or a shuso. And there are lots of kinds of it. But when you get to be a scapegoat, that's a little bit scary. And as long as she stays in her own space, you're fine. Mm-hmm. And you can just send her as much metta as you can generate. Mm-hmm. But if she starts encroaching on you, there are legal things that you can do to keep her out of your life. And maybe should.
Yeah. We share the driveway is all our deed, but everyone shares it.
Mm-hmm.
So to go to the street, I have to go right by her house.
She doesn't squirt water on your car as you go by.
She's not squirting water, and she's not let the dog out, which is good, to run after me or anything. But I can tell, you know, I hear the dog barking whenever we open the door, and I know it's the dog is picking up the energy she's got.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's your opportunity. One of the many, as we live our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And be safe.
Yeah.
maybe chanting at 5 a.m. and hitting some bells, perhaps, burning the incense.
At the gate.
Well, Andrew, you spoke just now about using the word charge, which kind of and the authentic self. Or for me, sitting is here, coming is to just try to get to know myself, my true self. And the hair gets grayer and longer, and I'm just sort of like caught in a bit of despair, and yet I know that doing this is probably is of some help, but it just feels it's like you pick out the leaves out of the moss garden diligently, they're all gone, and then the wind comes and they're there again the next day. I feel like yes, I mean, it'd be great to know my treasure house that's stored here and share it generously and open-heartedly. And, it's just so locked. I'm wondering, maybe a little shock therapy with a heart might help. I don't know what it's going to take. And so I know it's also the other side of no attainment, nothing to attain, and just no grasping for. There is some kind of, but I know I'm not as open-hearted as I'm sure I could be, as gentle as I could be with myself and with everything, mm-hmm. And I have a sense of despair.
Because you're not perfect?
Way far from it, though, is my point.
So you have a very high ideal that you're matching yourself to. But all those.
I see my closed down heart, generosity, time, service, whatever. And I go, back to the old compulsions and the little ego that's from childhood, in this grown body. And,
Well, and poor Heinrich, some of you got to know Heinrich at the last session here in August. From Germany, and he's the one that with Samia ran me to the ER when I fell. And he was at Poorag, and he got in trouble with the woman who was in charge of things at Poorag, very wonderful woman who was meltdown conditioned. She had just done several sesshins, and now there was a practice period, and then there was a wedding, and then there was a birthday, and so it was just, and then there we all were waiting for meals, and she was trying to keep everything together. And Heinrich is not very strong, and she didn't like him. And so she gave him all these tough jobs. And then when he didn't do them well, she would poke at him and criticize him, and finally he said he had to go home, he just couldn't take it. Mm-hmm. So we had a little meeting, and he said, my grown-up can take all this, but all my little children are so hurt by the things you do and say, I just can't, they just can't stay here. So there's so many aspects of us, and there are some very tender and gentle ones that need our protection. And we can't drive ourselves to perfection and try to be some perfect person, which we'll never, ever be. But just to learn to take good care of the whole system, moment by moment. Take care of it as it comes up. If you make a mistake, then apologize and go on. If you do something really wonderful, be happy and go on. But don't bundle up your life as if it were one thing, because it's not. You can't put a judgment on it. Oh, it's this really good life or this really bad life. It's just a life. and some of it's fabulous and some of it's not. But it's you. So you don't have to throw any of it away.
I think I get a little hung up with the word authentic for me, what that really is me, you know, not what, you know, I've learned here, there, or even taken on with joy, but is that, you know, that really peeling the onion to really more know my own treasure house?
I don't think you can. If you peel that onion, you just get to an empty place. So the treasure house is a way of talking about Alaya Vijnana, which is the eighth consciousness in this sort of setup that they have about what makes a bodhisattva, that all beings have are an aggregate of stuff. An aggregate in geology is just different rocks all somehow glued together, all different kinds of rocks. Well, we're the rocks of noses and eyes and ears and skin and all the things that make up a body and a mind. And then there are aspects of the mind that are trying to conduct us in a certain way, sort of like the doorman, you know, letting some things in and not letting others in. And the in part is just an enormous barn full of not only our stuff, but going all the way back to Adam and Eve and before them. It's just full of everything, all the conditioning, all the experiences, all the ideas, all the everythings are in there. Mm-hmm. And as Thich Nhat Hanh says, there are seeds in there of conduct, and some are seeds that will, if you water them, will grow up something that's very helpful and useful. And there are wicked seeds that you want to keep down there. Buddha said the same thing. This is his second noble truth. So you've got this barn full of junk and full of, you know, Rousseau and Voltaire and Jesus and Confucius and everything you can think of. But as long as it's in the dark, as long as you're not aware of it, and as long as you're trying to pick and judge each thing that comes up in your mind as something, yes, this is good, yes, this is good, no, I don't want that thing, it just becomes a whole thing about you. An authentic life isn't worried about you anymore. It's just worried about how to do this thing in the best way. Whatever this thing is right now. And if you can be like that without trying to measure yourself against somebody else, you'll be in Fat City.
And all the suffering there is, and of course the news, I mean, there maybe always has been, there always has been suffering, but perhaps with the news now, so boom, 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 you know, Sandy storm, or, you know, just the way it comes, it just is so overwhelming. And, you know, other than just doing my own life and whatever I can, I don't know, that just that anguish is with me all the time, you know. I mean, even the people from Katrina are still homeless, so many. And I don't know if there's anything you can comment about that.
As one well. Thing that helps me is to sometimes put up the name of whatever happened, like the disaster in Japan. where they're still suffering, where those people still have no place to live, like Sandy, like, I mean, there are times when I walk out of a week in Sesshin and it's been so peaceful and so fine, and walk out and something really ghastly, horrible has happened. And it's shocking when you aren't prepared for it. But the Chernobyl thing happened during Sesshin, the chemical disaster in India happened during Sesshin. All during the years, it happens that way. And I think Nina's way is a very good one. We can't fly to Russia or to Long Island or someplace and try to help people. It's just too much. And that's why it feels so too much. But we can take it into our mind and our heart and send them all the best wishes you can generate, all the loving kindness. And I put the names, you know, on the altar just to remind me that there they are, they're suffering, and they're in my life too. But it's not personal. Their suffering isn't personal. It's just what happened. And my being with them isn't personal. I'm just sending them all my love that I can. And you've got a lot of that. You can, you know, gift them.
Yeah. In response to that, I often think of what Coben has said about life is just one small thing after another. And I think that when we talk about a whole big disaster, a whole big anything, it's overwhelming, and then we can't deal with it. There's no answer to that. But we can smile at someone at the supermarket or whatever, or if we're living close to where the disaster is, you know, you can do a small thing. But that's what life is just one small thing after another. And I think we sometimes expect too much of ourselves to solve problems, and it's just our mind kind of playing with the thing, and then we have to, I guess, see the reality of what, you know, what life is and do whatever we can. And a smile goes a long way. The other day I had an appointment to see someone, and I was looking forward to it, and I thought it would be, you know, a very nice experience. And on the way there, I just sort of bumped into a stranger, and I won't go into all the details, but we had this wonderful encounter that just moved me so much, and my heart felt like it was massaged, and we both felt wonderful. And then I went to meet the friend, and that experience turned out to be kind of a bummer, but not a real bummer, but, you know, not, I guess I had expectations of it, and it wasn't that great. But on the way there, something wonderful did happen, so you never know. Life has lots of surprises.
Yes. Jane, you had something?
Well, you're asking if we're going to solve something in sitting. So I found the looking up very helpful for getting sleepy. Another thing I do in Kundalini Yoga, there's, of course now I'm not going to remember the name of it. Doesn't matter. I think it's Mula Bell. Doesn't matter. Where you let all of the air out and then kind of lock your neck, your throat, I should say. And then you tighten your stomach muscles, all of your genital muscles, you're in this, and it's like that. And you just hold or stay that way as long as you can with all of the energy. And it generates energy. Then you could do it repeatedly or just once. And if you get sleepy behind the wheel, it can help too.
That's a good thing.
Munabandha, I believe it's called. Mm.
Do you let the air in all at once? It's like that?
Gently, so that I'm not disturbing my meditation
okay.
So, and it can be a bit of a trick because you don't want to go when you breathe in again. So it is possible to do it gently.
Hmm.
And yes, I do kind of exhale as much as I can.
They do, one thing about them is they do everything. They try anything, it seems like. So the last talk was on Tonglin. And actually I had done that in the past and it was wonderful. When I couldn't meditate because I had a herniated disc, so I could just lie there and do it. And at the time it was to a lot of visualization to it. I'm assuming people know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it's Tibetan, and they visualize the sky. They to get in your meditation space, and to do that, they visualize the sky, and then they so they're there, and then they take in the pain of the world, or just themselves, which is a place to start, and. And then on an in-breath, and then they breathe out compassion and all light and good. And it seems very effective. But Rick, who gave the talk, asked for comments afterwards on what we actually did it. And I told my story of the way it helped me before, but I said, this time when I did it, it sounded just like Zazen to me, or what we're always doing. But I said I didn't need the visualization because it seemed to me that I'm taking in my projections of whatever. For instance, a friend is very ill, and I can't help him, I don't think. I don't have any experience to make me believe that I can actually help him by meditating in this particular case. But I can withdraw my pain that I projected onto him and take that breath and open in myself. Because that's the only thing I can do. So, I just wondered what you thought of that, or if anybody understands what I'm saying.
I'm really glad you said that. I feel that that's sometimes the first thing is to let it penetrate our heart. And be with it, not to turn away, and not to get busy with projecting. It's the hardest thing, I think, just to be with just the other person. How is it for them? What can I do?
Mm-hmm.
Kola. We can't cure him, but we can send him love and doing what you're doing. That will help him. I mean, it will help him in passing. Just that energy, the love and the energy that the whole Sangha is putting around the two of them, I believe really does help.
I don't know. It doesn't matter to me, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't believe it or not believe it. I only know, you know, my own experience is, I think that would make me, or any person that's with someone who's dying, would make me able to be present there. And I think that is a gift.
Yeah.